calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the 6th of January, Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom. Happy Friday. Have a great weekend. Yeah, great to have you with us, as is always our want on the first hour of our Friday program. We have Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. We've been doing this for well over a year, I'd say pushing two now. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. I think of him as America's congressman. He's running now for the United States Senate. His website, bernie.org. And Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment is what we call it. You can, if you want to speak with him, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-TOM, 440-THOM, or 440-8466. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there, and you can say hi. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie.
Happy New Year to all of the listeners.
Well, thank you, and the same to you and your family. A bunch of things on the agenda here today. The fuel assistance program, low income heating assistance program, is
yep.
that it? LIHEAP?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. When you sit in your congressional office and your staff receives phone calls, you have a sense of what's going on in America and the pain and the problems that people are experiencing. Let me just rattle off some of the phone calls that we've been getting in my office, and I think congressional offices all over the country are getting the same calls, and that is this so-called Medicare prescription drug program is a nightmare for millions of seniors. You need a PhD in medical economics to be able to fill it out, and even those people are having trouble with it. It is enormously confusing, for a start. The federal administration, the Bush administration, is doing a horrendous job administering it. Their website is performing very poorly. Pharmacists just don't know what to do. And we're getting call after call. I mean, dozens and dozens of calls from seniors who are in tears, who are confused. Are they going to get the medicine that they take every day? This is not a joke. This is life and death kind of stuff. And we should not be punishing seniors in this way. These guys can't administer the program, and it's a terrible program to begin with. So we should remember, we should do a couple of things. Number one, short term, we need some changes to simplify it, to give people more options about if their first plan doesn't work out, to go to another plan, and so forth and so on. But more importantly, this whole prescription drug Medicare program needs a total overhaul. And what some of us have been fighting for from the very beginning is make it a simple Medicare program like the other Medicare programs, have strong benefits for our seniors, allow the government to negotiate prescription drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry so that we could lower the cost that the government has to pay. And in doing that, you can provide better and stronger benefits for seniors at less cost to taxpayers. You'll remember, Tom, that this particular bill, and now you see the real results of political action. This bill was written by the pharmaceutical industry. The fellow, the Republican chairman of the Commerce Committee, Billy Towson, who wrote the bill, is now working for pharma, the trade group, for the pharmaceutical industry at $2 million a year. And that bill, as many of the listeners will remember, was passed by the Republicans keeping the voting rolls open on the floor of the House for 3 additional hours, longest vote in the history of the U.S. House of Representatives. Arms were twisted, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, after keeping the rolls open for 3 hours, they passed it. And we're seeing the results of that terrible bill written by the industry for the industry and not for senior citizens. So that's number one. That's what we're seeing today. Today you'll see, you'll have noticed, I know many of the listeners did, front page of Wall Street Journal, I think it was. IBM is going to make radical changes in their pension plan. I'm sure I'm going to be hearing from IBM workers in Vermont on this, and that will result in lower benefits, pension benefits for IBM employees. But everybody should understand, this is not just IBM. This is part of a general assault which is taking place across corporate America, impacting millions of American workers, where the effort of corporate America now is to do away, eliminate defined pension plans, period. Those will be history if these guys get away with that. When we come back to Congress in February, this president will be doing 2 interesting things. He'll be asking us to raise the debt ceiling above the $8.2 trillion where it presently is, and that debt has soared under George Bush. He'll want to make it higher, and it's now about $27,000 for a man, woman, and child in this country. And at the same time as they want to raise the debt ceiling, Tom, guess what else they want to do? And that is they want to give even more tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country. So those are just the issues that are coming across my desk right now. Pain and anxiety for seniors because of this nightmarish prescription drug program. The continued assault on the middle class, whether it's taking away health care benefits or today it's pension benefits or whether it's moving jobs to China. You know, during Christmas, I'm sure many of the listeners were out shopping. And if you go to stores and you just look at labels, it's China, China, China. And you wonder what is being manufactured in America, and you wonder why it is that our standard of living is declining for the middle class and why poverty is increasing. So those are just some of the issues that are coming across my desk in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and the robust Bush economy, I mean, here the Bush administration is out saying, oh, the economy is doing great. It's doing better than it's ever done before. I mean,
you know,
something doesn't add up here.
It is really incredible. They were going nuts because I think it was last month, they created a few hundred thousand jobs, and this was the end all. What they created in their big month was less than Bill Clinton created on average. On average, President Bush is creating about 32,000 jobs a month. Bill Clinton created 237,000 jobs a month on average. So the economy is just soaring. Meanwhile, we also, in looking at statistics, see that median household income continues to decline compared to inflation, that the majority of workers in America are not earning wage increases to keep up with inflation, that even under Clinton, I'm not here to boast about the Clinton record, which was much better economically, of course, than Bush. But many of the new jobs that are being created are Walmart-type jobs, and we're looking at now the destruction of the automobile industry on top of many other industries. GM is going to lay off 30,000 workers, and companies like Walmart, who pay poverty wages, who provide minimal benefits, who are vehemently anti-union, they are the jobs that we're seeing ascending. I saw a report recently which talked about the flowing of white-collar jobs, information technology jobs, potentially by the millions to India. So all of these things tell me that what we're seeing in America are three separate countries, in a sense. One, for the poor people, poverty is increasing, desperation for many people. For the middle class, people working longer hours for low wages, wondering whether their kids are going to have a lower standard of living than they do, seeing their good jobs going abroad. But for the people on top, which is Bush's constituency, what we are seeing is those people making out like bandits. I haven't seen the economic studies. I can't tell you definitively, but it may well be that the top 1% is now doing better than at any time in the modern history of America. Last year...
Since 1929.
Pardon me? Since 1929. That's kind of an ominous thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what we're looking at is a nation which now has the largest gap between the rich and the poor, both in wealth and income, of any country on earth, and that gap is greater than any time, as you've indicated, since 1929. So those are the issues that we have got to address, and if we don't turn it around, we're going to have the sad spectacle of seeing our kids having a lower standard of living than their parents, despite huge increases of technology and worker productivity. And, man, that is something we have got to be focused on and just cannot allow Bush and his zillionaire friends to deflect our attention away from that.
It's truly mind-boggling. I understand that Walmart recently came out in favor of increasing the minimum wage. It's like there is this suggestion. It's like if the folks who make their money off people who are on the bottom end of the economic scale, Walmart, for example, are realizing that supply-side economics is nonsense and that if they want to make more money, we got to get more money into the hands of working people.
Well, I think you're probably being generous to them. I think that this is, my own view is probably, this is an effort to try to counteract just some of the very terrible media that they're getting.
You think it's
most
a PR
cases,
stunt?
They don't pay the minimum wage anyhow. They'll pay a buck or two more than that.
Right.
So it's not going to hurt them all that.
Right, that was my point. It wouldn't affect their expenses,
right.
But what it would do is it would give more money to the people who shop at Walmart, and
right.
Thus it would increase their revenues.
That's right.
And so even when Walmart is refuting supply-side economics, you got to know that there's something going on here in America. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, 866-440-8466 across the United States. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Lord have mercy on the blue collar man.
Indeed, my friends.
I'm a blue-collar man.
Especially in this day of the Bush administration, the rule by the conservative elite. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman with you, the Tom Hartman radio program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. It's Friday, the first hour of our Friday program, our regular Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, his website, bernie.org. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And Bernie, let's... Bernie, are you there?
Yeah, right here.
Okay, great. Bernie, let's go right to the phone lines here. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes, good day to you both.
Good day. How are you, Rick?
Good. Hey, Tom, before I forget, what is the name of that theme song you opened your show with? It sounds familiar to me. I just can't think of the name of it.
You mean just now, the bumper music that just came in?
Well, just when you opened your show, for instance, the very beginning.
Oh, no, that was custom done for us by a musician by the name of Jay, just the letter
okay.
J. You can find it on our website.
Anyway, first of all, Bernie, I do wish you continued success in your quest for the Senate. On the other hand, I sometimes think present-day Washington reminds me of the old Marx Brothers movie, Duck Soup, but we need more good people like you to make that not so. And I certainly was listening to your commentary there on the new Medicare program, the prescription drug plan for seniors. I tried to help my mother enroll, and she hasn't gotten her card yet. And
right.
There may be problems, but what I really wanted to talk about was I know your colleague, John Conyers, and maybe some other Democrats are looking into possible grounds for impeachment. Now, at this point, I know it's very early, and the Democrats don't have the majority, obviously, in either House, but if it were feasible and if the case could be proven, would you be on board an impeachment attempt?
Well, I mean, I think what's an interesting process is to see and to take a look in what ways the president may have violated the law. And might be subject to impeachment proceedings. But let me say this. Number one, you have Republican control of the House and the Senate, and it is not going to happen. And number two, more significantly, if it does happen, then you have Dick Cheney as your president. That will be a major step forward. And number three, what really concerns me about the whole process is what people, in my view, have got to do politically is be aggressive on a day-to-day political level in making sure the Republican Party and these right-wing extremists do not continue to run the White House, the House of Representatives, and the U.S. Senate. And I don't want to see enormous amounts of time and energy deflected into what will, in fact, not be, it ain't going to happen. And rather than doing the really hard work of door-to-door education and organizing so that we can remove the majority party from the control of the House and the Senate. Those are my concerns there, Rick. I think we got a real whole lot of work to do. We're fighting for power in this country in many ways. The Republicans have done a much better job, and it's time that progressives and working people began to take back power in the Congress.
Mike in Decatur, Alabama. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Hey, Mike. You got to listen to your telephone, not your radio.
Hey, how are you? I'm about to run out of a signal, I think, on my cell phone. I just wanted to tell the congressman wish him well in his quest for a Senate seat, and to also let him know that there's a lot of people here in the South, more than he might think, that would be proud to have him as a representative. If he's not averse to having out-of-state contributions, I'm going to get on his website and make one, and I'll get off the phone here. Thank you.
Yeah. Let me say, first
thanks
of all,
a lot,
thank
Mike.
You, Mike. And I say this, what I have always believed, I think a lot of the times our friends in the South are much maligned. I think, if anything, if you look at the economic reality facing many people in the South, these are people who have higher rates of uninsurance for health care. Wages are often lower. Poverty is higher. And I think in any serious effort, when we talk about serious political effort, we do not ignore our friends in the South. A lot of good working people there prepared to stand up and fight back and make sure that our government does not continue to represent just the wealthy and the powerful. So I thank Mike very much for his sentiments, and I do know that there are many people throughout the South who agree with him.
Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Bob in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hey, Bob.
How are you?
Great.
I have a question for you. I'm going on 53 years old. I've been a Teamster for about 27 years, and we're hearing a lot of rumors about, you know, these pensions being guaranteed. And I just wanted to know, basically, if there's anything that we could do or write or call or, you know, just what we can do.
Well, Bob, that's a fantastic question. And the Teamsters actually have a very strong pension program for their own workers. That's one of the accomplishments that they have secured. There is no question in my mind that there is a major assault on pension plans all over this country. And Congress just passed some legislation dealing with pensions, which in many respects is very weak. So I think that working people throughout this country have got to contact Congress, demand that we not only protect the pensions that working people have been promised, that we don't allow corporations to change their minds midstream, but that we develop new programs for retirement security for all Americans.
You know, when we come back, Bernie, I'd like you to just take a minute and explain the difference between a defined benefit and a defined contribution program. I think a lot of Americans, particularly younger Americans, don't know the difference between a 401k and a pension. And we'll get to that. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman program, Brunch with Bernie. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends.
Oh.
Indeed, talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. It's Friday. We're live. It's 34 minutes past the hour. 34 minutes past noon on the East Coast, 34 minutes past 9 on the West Coast, and you can calculate all about in between. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Our program, the first hour of our program Friday here, as always, Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, taking your telephone calls. Bernie, I had asked you before the break if you'd just give us a very short snapshot for those folks who are confused by these phrases, defined benefit versus defined contribution.
Defined, I mean, everybody will be happy to know that a defined benefit plan is exactly what members of the United States Congress have and what many workers have, and that is you make a contribution, in this case the government or your employer makes a contribution. Usually there's a formula that is based on, say, 3 years of your highest income, and then you know, and when it is defined and it is guaranteed, you know what you are going to get when you retire.
Until you die,
after, you know, depending on the program, it might be 20 years of employment that you're eligible, whatever it may be, you know what you're getting. And, of course, the 401k programs are much more fluid. You are not, there is no guarantee in terms of what you are going to get. It will depend on the success or failure of your investments, and you're unsure of what you are going to be receiving. And that's the essential difference.
So basically in this country, what we're moving away from is the old pension system where you know that you're going to retire with a check of,
right,
you know, $1,500 a month for the rest of your life,
and
or whatever it may be.
The importance of that is, Tom, people have to make a lot of choices during their employment careers, right? They go to a job that they enjoy, hopefully, where their wages are going to be decent, their health care benefits, and their pension plans. That's part of the consideration. And one of the sad aspects of the movement on the part of corporate America to destroy defined benefit plans is that workers may have given up, in many instances, other economic opportunities, but they stayed on their job for an extra 10 years because they said, you know what, I'm not making all that much money. I could do better if I left, but you know what, I know that I'm going to get a good pension when I retire because that's what they've told me. That's what they've guaranteed me. And now many companies are pulling out the rugs underneath those workers.
And then the company goes into bankruptcy or whatever and just changes the rules of the game all of a sudden on them.
Right. But this, as I mentioned earlier, it's part of the assault on the American middle class. It's this business of outsourcing, taking away good jobs. It's cutting back on health care. And now there's a real assault on pensions. And some of us in Congress are working very hard on this issue. But we are certainly going to need the support of millions of working people who stand up and say to Congress, don't let them steal the pensions that they promised us.
There you go. Let's go back to the telephone lines. John in Hartford, Connecticut, you are live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Hey, John. John, you may have to click him on there on your end, Alex, because my end doesn't seem to be working.
I'm here.
Oh, there you go, John. I'm sorry. Welcome.
I didn't know if you would heard about the topic that I called in about.
Go ahead, John.
Basically, the company Verizon, where I've been an employee for almost 14 years, a month ago came out with an email to all management employees that stated that as of June 30th, 2006, whatever years of accruement service you had was all you were ever going to receive as a pension. They froze it at 15 years. You had to have 15 years as of June 30th, 2006 to receive a pension. Now, these are people that have worked for the company even before divestiture back in 1989. So say, for example, if in 2006 you had 22, 23 years of service and planned on working an additional 10 years, you're still frozen at the pension bands of 23 years.
Now, I did hear about that. And John, that is precisely what is happening all over this country. And unless we stop it right now, there's no question that there's going to be a tsunami effect, and every company is going to do it. It starts off, you're seeing this in the automobile industry, in communications with Verizon. You're seeing it now at IBM, and it's going to spread because they're all going to say, well, gee, the other guy is doing it. The economic climate is changing, and if it's good for IBM or if it's good for General Motors or if it's good for Verizon, it's certainly going to be good for us. And what you have just described is what I mentioned a moment ago. Promises were made to employees, in this case, managers at Verizon. People stayed at the company, perhaps because of that pension promise, and now the rug is being pulled out from underneath them. And it is a real tragedy and part of the assault on the American middle class.
Michael in Essex, Vermont. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, hello. This is Michael from Essex, Vermont.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
Good, thanks. I really hope you get you the Senate seat. Don't let us down here. I'm a retired Air Force person. My pension, I know, goes on the whim of the Congress or the government. But I'm noticing now more and more in the media where we're demonizing pension plans.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying, oh, the company's not viable because of all these pension
mm-hmm.
plans. Well, my father's worked 40 years, 50 years in a company, and he's supposed to get a pension, and now he may not. You know, I'm worried about the people who are out there who are supposed to get a pension, and the companies are going bust and bankrupt and leaving no pensions behind.
Well, Michael, your concern is absolutely right on and legitimate, and I think people from, you know, California to Maine are terribly worried about whether or not the pensions that were promised to them or to their parents are going to be there for them. You will remember, Michael, that we dealt with this at IBM just in your town a few years ago.
Exactly.
About promises being made to workers that were not being kept, and we may have to deal with it again. But, you know, the question, Michael, that we have got to ask is why is this attack on pensions taking place? Are we in the middle of some kind of massive depression? Are corporations not seeing any profits? What they tell us is we have to look at the global climate and we have to compete against countries all over the world. Meanwhile, they encouraged us, among other things, to get into this Chinese trade agreement. We know that the CEOs, whether it's IBM or any other company, you remember what Lou Gerstner got from IBM when he left? I think he left with over $100 million in various benefits. So the CEOs are doing just great, but they're punishing their retirees, they're punishing their workers, and they're using all kinds of excuses. It's the global economy. Well, who was the one who encouraged us to get into permanent normal trade relations with China? It was them.
Yeah, and then this is something, by the way, that's not exclusive to the Republicans, but
oh, that's right. No,
it's the whole Tom Friedman madness that's sweeping the country. Larry in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I heard a rather dire report on the BBC last night concerning the future of the U.S. dollar, and in today's Wall Street Journal on page A2, there's a small report on it. China hints at shift in its U.S. Treasury assets. They claim that there's about $800 billion in foreign exchange reserves in China, of which about $250 billion of it is U.S. Treasury securities. But they want to diversify their foreign currency holdings, which is going to be done by abolishing the quota of foreign currency that Chinese companies are allowed to buy, unleashing a binge among cash-rich Chinese companies, which Stephen Green, senior economist for the Standard Chartered Bank, says this is a serious U.S. dollar negative. How is this going to affect our economy, and is George Bush going to mention anything about this in today's address?
Good question.
Very good point. All that I can say, and I haven't read what Barry was reciting, is all of us should be concerned not only about the huge and growing trade deficit we have with China, but also about the fact that China is owning more and more of our debt. And it's not only has a potential impact on our dollar, it also obviously affects our geopolitical relationship with China. If we are deeply indebted to these people, it's going to significantly impact how we relate to them on a whole wide range of policy issues. So I think the point is that the caller makes is an excellent one. It's an issue we should be very concerned about.
The other story in the paper today about China was that Microsoft is helping them censor the internet over there. I mean, it's just...
Well, I was involved. I mean, this whole China issue, Tom, is worth a program unto itself. I was involved, and we passed an amendment. I passed an amendment on the floor of the House, which ended up getting defeated in the Senate, by which taxpayer money was going to a British government-owned firm to build nuclear power plants in China. So the American taxpayers are subsidizing the development of nuclear power plants in China. And sometimes you wonder who the heads of these large American multinational corporations are concerned about, whether it's the American people or the Chinese government.
Yeah, well, that British company was Westinghouse. I mean, it's like how many of our American companies are now no longer American companies?
Yep.
This is a whole other issue. All these guys are sitting on all this cash because we've had these insane trade policies, and now they've got to use all these American dollars for something. They're using them to buy up the United States. And then when they run their businesses here, they take their profits home. They don't leave the profits here in the United States.
That's right.
So, anyway, it's a tough one here. Fritz in Santa Fe, we have about a half a minute, enough time to get a question out. Bernie can answer it after the break.
Hi gentlemen. I'm tremendously concerned about this whole issue, particularly when it comes to Alito getting onto the Supreme Court. And I just called my senator and urged him to join in a filibuster based on this imperial presidency idea. But, you know, the contribution Alito could make to corporate dominance is just as dangerous. I'd like Bernie's, commentary on that. Thank
Great.
You.
We'll get his thoughts on that right after this break. Fritz in Santa Fe, thanks a lot for that call. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, his website, bernie.org. The Tom Hartman radio program, 866-440-8466. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Will you come down from your ivory tower?
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour here on the radio support group of, by, and for, we, the people of the United States, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website. And Bernie, just before the break, a caller asked you about the imperial presidency and Sam Alito's take on it.
Right. And he raises a very important question. The truth of the matter is we are a divided country. I think Bush's right-wing extremism goes nowhere near representing a majority of the people. It's a relatively small minority. And what the president who came to office, Tom, you'll recall, as a uniter, not a divider, has got to understand is that we are sick and tired of him appointing right-wing extremists and ideologues rather than people who represent the views of the vast majority of the people. Now, the concern that Fritz was raising is that a Supreme Court appointee now in a divided court will deal with more than just Roe versus Wade, which is the issue I think that most people talk about. It talks about decisions that will be made about the power of the president compared to Congress and the American people. Is Alito supportive of what Bush wants to do, which is to say that in many cases the Constitution or the laws don't apply to him because he can do pretty much what he wants to do? What about the ability of government to stand up for working people and pass legislation? Is that going to be an intrusion on the rights of corporate America or business owners? What about protecting the American people from environmental degradation? How does Alito feel about the role of government in that regard? So there are a lot of very, very important issues that the Senate Judiciary Committee has got to raise with Mr. Alito before they make their decisions. But I continue to have real concerns that in a divided nation, rather than trying to bring people together, Bush goes to the extreme right wing for his appointments.
Nate in St. Cloud, Minnesota. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, guys. I really appreciate you having this segment on every Friday. I listen with the pen and paper. And my question is, what do I say to a guy who says, oh, our economy isn't skating on thin ice. We're just going through a phase right now, and this is, you know, this is, no one could mess up our economy. It's so, you know, it'll bounce back. No one could, you know, to me it seems like, you know, Bush is trying to dismantle, our whole system, our whole, you know, whether it's, pensions or, you know, it seems like every different thing, he's just trying to take it apart and it all, and people, like, I know people who work two full-time jobs, and they're still going,
right.
Yeah, it's just a phase. We'll go through it, you know, and you don't know what you're talking about, Nate.
Well, I think one of the things, you raise a really good question, and Tom and I often talk about how people know what they know and talk about the media and who owns the media and why we talk so much about crime and don't talk so much about the decline of the middle class. The fact of the matter is, I mean, I think we have to get good information out to people, and we have a lot of good websites out there, a lot of good, you know, magazines and newspapers, but the reality today, which is not talked about, doesn't surprise me that people who are working their tails off, seeing a decline in their real wages, not being able to afford to send their kids to college, are like, oh, this is just a passing phase. What they don't know, because not too many people are talking about it, is that real wages for American workers has gone down very significantly in the last 30 years, despite an increase in worker productivity. How many of the people who you talk to know that we are the only nation in the industrialized world not to have a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people? How many of the people that we talk to know that college education?
And then, but they say, oh, we got the best health care, though. You
that's
know?
Because
they don't know if it's the most wasteful. They don't believe that. They just think it's the best.
Well, if you have a lot of money, it is the best. And what we have got to do is to educate people about what goes on in other countries around this country. The fact that we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. The healthcare system is not the best if you can't afford to get it, is it?
No. I have multiple sclerosis, and that's a whole different story, you know, but... So I know about that. I mean, I have to change my whole living situation just to get the help I need to get the medicine, you know, and it's just...
I think one of the things, and you're raising a good question, and one of the things is we have given up the capacity for vision, to ask ourselves why, with all of the technology out there. We are not doing better. What is the reason that all people in America do not have good quality health care as a right of citizenship? Why? Why don't we have that? Why is, you mentioned the fact that you know people are working two full-time jobs. Today, a two-income family has less disposable income than a one-income family had 30 years ago because real wages have gone down. Why is that? And again, to answer your question, a lot of people don't know this because they don't hear that discussion. You know, we hear about Paris Hilton's life. We hear about O.J. Simpson. We hear about Michael Jackson. But we don't hear about why the middle class is shrinking, why poverty is increasing. How much discussion do we hear about that? Hearing about who got us into this trade policy with China, the same people who are bemoaning, you know, all the things that are happening in America today are exactly the same people who forced us into this trade agreement with China, so that American workers are now forced to compete against desperate people with no democratic rights who make 30 cents an hour. So we've got a lot of educating to do. And by the way, one of the reasons I enjoy being on this program with Tom is I think Tom does a great job in expressing different points of view than many Americans ordinarily hear. But thanks for the call.
Thanks a lot, Nate. And Bernie, we're wrapping it up here. So final comment. We need to get politically active, Bernie.
We need to be politically active 365 days a year because our opponents are, in fact, doing that.
There you go. Yeah, this is something we've got to take seriously. There's an election coming up in another 11 months here, and time to pay attention to it. And thanks so much, Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, Bernie.org, his website. Check it out. Bernie, we'll see you again in 2 weeks.
You got it. Take care, Tom.
Thanks a lot. It's 57 minutes past the hour, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 6 minutes past the hour. The place where being progressive never felt so good. Our quote for the day: the time has come that the American people know exactly what the representatives are doing here in Washington. Are they feeding at the public trough, taking lobbyist paid vacations, getting wined and dined by special interest groups? The American people have a right to know. Our quote for the day from Tom DeLay, 1995. David Tebow is with us. He's the editor and chief of CNS News, cnsnews.com. David, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. Thanks very much for inviting me, and I'm glad to be with you.
Pleased to have you with us, David. CNS, what does that stand for?
It's cnsnews.com, actually,
right?
Just to get the name right. It's Cybercast News Service is
okay.
our adult name, so to say.
And cyber, there you go. And you characterize yourself as a conservative website?
Well, I'll tell you what we do, Tom. We are willing to let everybody weigh in on
mm-hmm.
every story we do,
mm-hmm.
Which we think is quite different from a lot of the establishment media. And we do stories that conservatives are interested in, stories that tend to get either underreported or unreported by most of the establishment media.
Okay, and there's a story that you wanted to talk about today.
Well, you know, it's a story that you folks asked to talk to me about. And
oh, okay. I'm sorry. Didn't realize it went that way around.
Abortion and mental health problems.
Okay. And this is a story that you carried on cnsnews.com.
Right.
And it suggested what?
Well, it's actually one of many stories we've done about this topic over the years that has some empirical data about women who, upon undergoing abortions, later on suffered some psychological, emotional effects, which even took on physical symptoms. And they have reported this situation in studies, and the studies have been culled and reported. And in the most cases neglected or unreported by the rest of the establishment media, but it's the kind of story that we do on CNSnews.com, and we have done this periodically as reports have come out over the years.
Well, I read the story, and I went back and looked at the study, in fact, and it seems to me like this is badly flawed by sample bias. I mean, in this study, number one, you're going to find that women who are mentally unstable to begin with are more likely to be promiscuous, therefore they're more likely to end up pregnant.
Why would you say that, Tom? Why would you say that?
I would say that because I think it's common sense, first
you
of
think?
All. Yeah, I think so.
So everybody who's promiscuous is mentally unstable?
No, I didn't say that. That's a reversal of my logic. Now, I'm saying that as somebody who worked in the mental health field for a number of years. I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for severely emotionally disturbed children for 5 years. I was certified by the state of Vermont as a psychotherapist, and I've been on the board of this organization for 27 years. I have some familiarity with this topic.
You sound very well credentialed.
And, well, I'm at the bottom of the food chain of the credentials, but I have some. And so, back to my point.
Right.
If you have somebody, if you have a woman who is, to begin with, mentally unstable, she may be more likely to be promiscuous. That promiscuity may be one of the ways that instability manifests itself, which may mean that she's more likely to end up with an unwanted pregnancy, which may mean that she's more likely to end up with an abortion. And so when you simply look at a sample of women who have gotten abortions and notice that the percentage of them who have, you know, in later life mental illness problems is slightly higher than the percentage of the women who didn't get abortions, I consider that a study that's flawed by what's called sample bias in the literature. And in fact, Everett Koop, back in the 1980s, who, by the way, believes that abortion should be against the law. Everett Koop is an anti-choice or a pro-anti-abortion guy. Everett Koop looked at two studies in the late 1980s that looked at over 10,000 women, which is much larger than the study that you're looking at, and came to the conclusion that the emotional problems following abortion are minuscule from a public health perspective.
Well, if I might, Tom, I think your initial assumption would insult a lot of people who represent the mentally handicapped.
I'm not talking about mental handicaps. I'm talking about people who...
Well, unstable, however you want to characterize it.
I'm talking about people who are, for example, prone to depression. I mean, the exact kinds of things that you were defining in your study as later life consequences. Alcoholism, substance abuse, and depression.
Abortion would get you to feeling that way just
by
itself?
I think that it's possible. I think that any major life decision, I think having an unwanted child could cause somebody to become depressed or a person who might have the tendency toward it to end up being a drug or alcohol abuser as well. I think, you know, any kind of major life decision that can be spun in any different way could have that kind of outcome. I'm not disputing that. What I'm suggesting is that I think that two things. Number one, I think that this is part of a larger attempt to demonize abortion, number one. And I don't think it's a particularly successful one because, as I said, the study's flawed.
Well, I agree with you there. I don't think there's any question, Tom, that these studies are, for the most part, fueled by people who are pro-life who do see abortion as a demonic thing. I mean, they do see it as evil.
Right. And number two, what baffles me is that we have 12 million children living in poverty in the United States right now. The worst of any industrialized country in the world. We have more children today in poverty than there were 20 years ago. 17% of children of all children in the United States right now living in poverty.
Right.
18% people under 18 experience a poverty rate increase from 16.9% in 1999 to 17% in 2000. Child poverty is growing in the United States.
Right.
7% of America's children live in extreme poverty where their families are earning less than $6,000 a year. Why are we not concerned about that?
Well, Tom, let me ask you this. If you could retroactively abort those children born in poverty, who would you select and who would you leave out?
It's a totally inappropriate question, David. We're talking about David Tebow. He's the editor and author.
You're suggesting that all of those people born in poverty, for some justification dealing with poverty, ought to have been aborted.
No, I never suggested that. What I'm suggesting is that if we want to proclaim ourselves to be a pro-life culture, that we should be attending to those among us who are already alive.
And
that there are 12 million children in America who are already alive. And I don't hear these guys who are mostly men who are running around talking about abortion, talking about taking care of these 12 million children who are already alive and living in severe poverty in the United States.
Well, that's a very complicated subject matter, Tom. You know that. That has a lot to do with.
But where is the morality of the right, David?
By the parents once they have the children. But you're using that as justification for abortion. Now,
I'm not
going to debate abortion with you, Tom. I'm just going to say that this story that we did merited some attention, and it gets ignored by the establishment media. I know what your views obviously are regarding abortion. You're entitled to those views. But be clear about what you're saying. When you talk about children born in poverty, and you think that's a bad thing, and you're using that to justify.
First of all,
abortion.
I didn't say born in poverty, David.
As a matter of fact, we have enormous numbers of children
who have slid into poor poverty.
Under any circumstances. A lot of conservatives will say that. You're entitled to your view, but conservatives and pro-life people feel that abortion is unjustified no matter what the economic circumstances.
Well, and it even goes beyond abortion, doesn't it, David? I mean, here we have a very strong section of your constituency out there actually arguing against, for example, Plan B, which is not an abortion pill, it's a birth control pill.
Well, it depends on how far you want to go.
We're really talking about the control of women, aren't we, David?
About an abortifacient.
No, Plan B is not an abortifacient.
Plan B certainly has the possibility of being an abortifacient.
It is not an abortifacient. It takes 72 hours.
That's your opinion.
That's the science. David, please read it.
It's a scientifically debated subject, and you know it. Plan B is a scientifically debated subject. It has the potential to implant and serve as an abortifacient. You know that.
It takes 72 hours for the sperm to make its way all the way up into the fallopian tubes to
This is a debatable subject, Tom. You're giving your listeners an idea that this is a done deal, a fait accompli. It's not.
RU486 is an abortifacient. Plan B is not.
We're talking hormones and birth control pills. But I'm telling you that I have heard from a lot of people who say it can't be. It isn't always, but it can be.
I'm not even hearing that argument for the people who are arguing against Plan B, David.
Well, you're not listening very
well. What I'm hearing from them is that they're afraid it's going to encourage promiscuity.
That Plan B is going to encourage promiscuity?
Right.
Well, it may very well.
Yeah, well, you know.
Are you saying it won't?
Well, their argument is the availability of any kind of birth control is going to increase promiscuity, and therefore we shouldn't have birth control. It's an interesting conversation. David Thiebaud, editor-in-chief of CNS News, cnsnews.com. David, thanks for coming on with us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Anytime.
You give as well as you get. I appreciate it. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends, to the True People's Radio. It's the real free speech zone. Now, no barbed wire. No police chasing you down if you dare have a carry sign or a gore sign. We're not going to drag you out of here if you've got a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. Or for that matter, if you've got a Bush Cheney bumper sticker on your car, everybody's welcome on this program. In fact, I would say to the poor, terrified conservative who has been calling our hardworking board op Dan and playing Rush Limbaugh into the phone for him, hey, you don't have the courage to just call and talk to me? I'll put you on the air. You just have to ask yourself one question. Am I feeling lucky? And if you think you are, give us a call. 1-866-440-8466. Hey, punk! We'll be going to our phone calls in just a moment. First, Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service is with us. Hey, Victoria, what's up in Washington, D.C. today?
I was just thinking of the next line for this. So, do you feel lucky, punk?
Yeah, there you go.
Great.
And then it goes, bam, bam!
Such a good film.
Yeah, it really was.
Well, the president's been speaking, and he just said the economy is strong, and we intend to keep it.
Right. The economy is strong. We're creating all kinds of $6 an hour jobs. Isn't it great? We're losing our $20 and $30 an hour jobs like crazy, but we're making up $6 an hour jobs like never before.
And they're part-time jobs, so it means you have more leisure time.
There you go. Yeah.
Do all the stuff you can't afford to do.
There are fewer people drawing unemployment because more people's unemployment benefits have expired.
Right. So it is fascinating. It's a kind of an up-and-down world, and the question is who's buying it. Clearly, the administration's a little worried because several cabinet members are out there today giving speeches on the same theme. They basically sent about five or six of them out doing exactly the same thing, talking about the economy and how great things are. In fact, I think I can give you some names. The Vice President's going to be out, Secretary of the Treasury, Commerce, Energy. That's just the start.
Yeah. So it's the big lie strategy recycled. I mean, we've been watching this for 5 years. They say something that, they get their talking points for the day, they get their message, they boil it down to the point where they know it'll be repeated as a soundbite in the evening news and that the conservative talk shows can pick it up and work it over. And whether or not it has any relationship to reality, they just drum, and a certain percentage of the people are going to believe it.
Exactly.
Things are
exactly.
just great. Don't believe your lying eyes. Things are just great.
Exactly.
So
is that
Sam Alito, the Wall Street Journal yesterday outed him on the front page, and there's this growing discussion about how the intersection of George W. Bush's claiming an imperial presidency, basically, saying he can do whatever he damn well pleases, he's the president, and the fact that all of this really began during the Reagan administration with Reagan trying to grab power, and that the guy behind it was a lawyer in the Reagan administration, Sam Alito, who in 1986 wrote the doctrine suggesting that when a president signs a law, he should attach to it a so-called signing statement, presidential signing statement, in basically making the argument in advance for any court that may look at that law down the road about exactly what the president has to say about it, even though the Constitution does not give the president the authority to create law. Only Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, have that authority. Are you seeing or hearing in Washington, D.C., from the politicians that you know and you talk to and you interview on a regular basis, Victoria Jones, are you hearing any kind of blowback? Is this starting to become an issue, this conflating or mixing together Sam Alito and presidential overreach?
It's starting to. I mean, the Sam Alito connection with President Bush, with executive power, with, of course, the Fourth Amendment, these are all things that are becoming increasingly hot as we draw into the weekend. And I can predict that the Sunday TV talk shows are going to be all over this. Unless Sharon dies, it's going to be the main topic. I mean, we already have the Democrats saying that they want to delay the up and down vote. The Senate Judiciary Committee is actually only supposed to be holding hearings Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday next week. I'm actually in the Senate right now. But the rumor is that they will extend and do Thursday and Friday. Mm. And this because everyone's going to want their second round and their third round of questioning, because this is going to be quite, quite lively.
Yeah, and now all the interest groups are out there running the ads and running them rather aggressively. I've been, frankly, very impressed with some of the stuff coming out of People for American Way. Ralph Neese and his bunch have really been doing their research on this guy, and what they've been finding, frankly, for me is scary.
It would be very interesting to see how he manages to refuse to answer questions about issues which he's made a very clear statement.
Yeah, Roberts was actually quite good at doing that, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was very good. I mean, he really did set the standard. Alito apparently is less polished, but also less cautious.
Yeah. I mean, Roberts he did not answer so many questions we're not revisiting the Roberts. We just have a few seconds left, Victoria. What do you see coming down the road next week? Is it going to be Sam Alito all Sam all week?
Yes, I think it's going to be all Sam all week. If Sharon dies over the weekend, obviously we'll have the fallout from that. There may be more revelations in the spying scandal. I don't know, but I think people do not want it to go away.
And so do you expect investigations into mine safety to be happening?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Okay. So we'll see how this all shakes out. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks so much for being with us. It's 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the Matrix.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. Shake it up. And welcome back, my friends. Shake it up. Where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're Jeff Gannon. Welcome back to the program. Truth in Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman Radio Show. 34 minutes past the hour. You know, we occasionally get mail, and sometimes it's time to, you know, it's useful to just kind of take a look.
You know, it's nice when the postman has a letter in his sack for you, because the mail must go through.
There you go, the mail must go through.
The mail must go through.
I received an email from Jane. And she said, I've never written to a talk show host before. I wanted to know however, how deeply offended, that is an understatement, I was by your comparison of George W. Bush to Adolf Hitler, with Hitler described favorably as a decorated war hero. She says, if you're a right-minded person, you will apologize. Shame on you. And so I just wanted to say, I apologize. Jane, you're right. You're absolutely right. The context was, we had a caller called, I believe it was Monday of this week, on New Year's Day. Caller called and said, I don't think that you can make comparisons between Bush and Hitler. And I said, you're right. Hitler was a decorated war hero. And then, you know, it was just kind of a throwaway line, and then the conversation went on. And some people, I think, might have thought that I meant in the context of World War II, and I didn't. I lived in Germany for a little over a year, 86, 87. I need not go through my credentials on this. In any case, the point is, Hitler was a madman. He was a maniac. He was a mass murderer, one of the most horrible persons who ever, if you could even use the word person, whoever lived in the history of the human race. And during World War I, he received the Iron Cross with the flag for bravery, which is one of the three highest awards, I believe, that you can get in the German military, and was wounded in combat and ended up actually blinded in a mustard gas attack and was in the hospital for some time and was not able to go back to combat. And I was simply making the point that George W. Bush, when called upon to serve his country in time of war, chose not to serve, but rather chose to use his father's influence to get him out of the press. So, thank you for pointing that out. I appreciate it. Also, another one, this is from Paul in Seattle. He says, I love the way you debated that writer this morning. Whenever some homophobe tries to quote the Bible to me, I also quote it back. He says, my favorite verse is, Jesus said, love thy neighbor as thyself. He says, there's no stipulation on that statement. There's no unless. Jesus did not say, love thy neighbor, unless he's gay or black or Muslim or anything else. And then he says, and don't dog on Leviticus so much. He says, sure, it says we can't eat shellfish, but it does say that we can eat locusts and beetles. Fair trade, if you ask me. I mean, who wants to slurp squishy oysters when you can crunch on a cockroach? So thank you, Paul, for that. Interesting the mail. And then, of course, we have Pat Robertson. And Pat Robertson with his, he's gone off the edge. Last month or the month before that, he was calling for the murder of the head of state of Venezuela, and now he is saying that instead of encouraging people to murder other people, he's saying that maybe God wants to murder people.
God has enmity against those who, quote, divide my land. And for any prime minister of Israel who decides he's going to carve it up and give it away, God says, no, this is mine. Now, Ariel Sharon, who is, again, a very likable person, a delightful person to be with, I prayed with him personally, but here he's at the point of death. He was dividing God's land.
So you don't mess with Pat, man, and you don't mess with I was going to say with Pat's God, and I increasingly, the White House now has disavowed what Pat said, and so I think increasingly this is Pat's God, not that of the rest of us, shall we say, or many, many of the rest of us. 38 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Will in Brea, California. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Good day, truth teller. How's it going?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Will?
Oh, wait, cool. This is about the Abracadabra guy?
Yeah, okay. Jack Abramoff, yeah.
Yeah. Why don't we, I was hoping to get through before and ask future Senator Bernie whether or not we should wait on this whole Alito thing until all the crooks that need to be in jail are there and we have, like, honest people.
You'll only have about 70 members of the Senate, and they'll all be Democrats or moderate Republicans.
The honesty thing is not the bigger factor of who they got on their ticket, like a little letter, that's more important.
Yeah, well, that's you know, where I was saying, you know, our quote for the day, and I think it's a marvelous quote for the day, is from 10 years ago. And it's from a member of the House of Representatives. He says, "The time has come that the American people know exactly what their representatives are doing here in Washington. Are they feeding at the public trough, taking lobbyist paid vacations, getting wined and dined by special interest groups? The American people have a right to know." And that was Tom DeLay.
Yeah, our favorite guy.
Yeah, there you go. So, Will. Yeah, well, I'm not sure I can say that I think that the Abramoff thing should be played out before the Alito thing, because the Alito thing, you know, there is a constitutional requirement for all this, and the Abramoff thing may be some time as we unravel this, but we'll see how it plays out. Susan in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening there on KRXA, isn't it? Susan?
Hello,
Susan.
Oh,
you're
hi.
Right.
Hi,
you're
Tom. Right. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You're live on the air.
I'm doing. How are you doing?
Fine.
Good.
What's up?
I just wanted to know what's his name, Tebow, whatever.
David Tebow, our guest here from the beginning of this hour. Yeah.
Yeah, I really didn't get his point because you guys got to kind of, you know, bantering with each other and.
Mm-hmm. His point was that there is this study that came out of New Zealand.
Uh-huh.
That indicated that there's a slightly higher risk among women who have had abortions later in life of turning to alcohol, drugs, suicide, having emotional and mental problems.
Okay. Well,
it's a study that is now flying all over the right wing websites.
And that's to what? To against abortion.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
I just wanted to speak to that for a moment because I am a woman and I also did have. An unwanted abortion. I don't think abortions are wanted.
I don't know any. I know several women who've had abortions, and I don't think any of them were enthusiastic about it.
They aren't really wanted. I mean, people get between a rock and a hard place where they have nowhere to go.
Mm.
And I was even married, but I knew if I didn't do it, it was the end of my marriage. And if I did, you know, it was. Anyway, what I was going to say is, not only people do have. Repercussions to having abortions, but they're not very much different from what happens when one has a miscarriage also.
Mm-hmm.
There are very similar kinds of psychological events that happen, usually around the time the child would be born.
Yeah. In fact, my wife Louise, who also helps produce this program, is sitting in the studio with me, and she just indicated I can tell this story. We have three children, and between the first and the second one, Louise had a miscarriage, and we've been through that.
Yeah.
And it is a tough one. And also, Susan, I would add, having a child is a tough thing, and having an unwanted child is a tough thing. On and on it goes. I mean, it's just not so simple.
Wanted to add to that is that there's really hardly any state that can't be kind of reversed, and that there are a lot of events in our lives that are traumatic that cause us to grow, and I think that the result of most of the trauma around abortions does cause people to grow, and once they heal, it's really not much different than anything else. But
I agree.
It is different, but it's not a reason to be against.
Right, and the thing that I would add to that, Susan, is that I think that a lot of women right now who have had abortions in the past are being traumatized by the anti-abortion zealots more than they are by the abortion. So.
Yeah, I don't know that these folks are quite anti-woman.
and that's ultimately the message. Yeah. Susan, thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Parviz, am I pronouncing that right? In Larchmont,
yes,
New York.
Sure. Tom, first of all, I want to say you're a giant of an intellectual. I've listened to you on the radio, Air America, and really, you're great.
Thank you.
And I have to get your books. I mean, I'm so excited now to read your books.
Oh, good.
Okay, I'm originally
my publisher thanks you.
Yeah, I'm originally from Iran.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to say, I want to denounce what the president of Iran said, that Holocaust didn't happen.
Yes.
I think he's just saying it for internal consumption and for rhetoric, and
yeah.
He doesn't mean it. And Iranians, most of the Iranians don't want war. If you go and study the history of Iran, just recent history, in the 80s, Taliban killed Iranian journalists, Iranian politicians, and the people said we have to go at war with Taliban. And president of Iran at that time, Khatami, very wise man, said no. War creates more death, more difficulties, more misery.
Mm.
So he was wiser than Bush.
Yeah, your
now,
message.
I want to express my anger at Bush. This administration, these people in Washington, D.C., they think they're above us. You know, I'm from Middle East. They think they're wiser than me, better than me, better than us. So they want to go over there and say, we're going to give you freedom. The morons do not understand. Freedom should be fought for. We have to fight for our own freedom, not somebody come and use it as an excuse to get our oil.
Absolutely. You are so right, Parviz, and I thank you so much for that, for sharing that with me.
Let me give my own experience.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, we're out of time on this segment.
I love
but thank you very
happy
much. I really appreciate it. Thank you, and the same to you and all holidays. Great to hear from you. And I'll tell you a story about Dick Gregory when we come back from this break. We'll take a few more phone calls. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
What a wonderful, wonderful world this would be. What a wonderful, 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 wonderful world.
And welcome back, my friends, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. Back in 1980, as I recall. It might have been 81. It was 1980 is when I first went into Uganda. It was during the war when Tanzania had invaded Uganda to throw Idi Amin out. And Amin fled and along with his troops up through the north, through the Karamoja region, into Sudan and then up north. And he ended up in Saudi Arabia, where because he had converted to Islam, he and his many wives and children lived in a palace until the day he died, which was just a few years ago, actually, was kept like a king. But in any case, I went into Uganda during that war because I've been doing volunteer relief work with German charity Kinder und Jugendhilfswerk Salem, based in Stettsteinach, Germany, since 1978, and continue to. In fact, I was over in Stettsteinach three weekends ago, the day that Peter B. Collins filled in for me, that Friday and Monday. And in any case, I had been over there, and we had took over the Namalo prison farm, which was a place where Idi Amin used to not literally eat people. He would disembowel people and then lick the knife as they died. His particular brand of religion, this was his pre-Islam conversion, dictated that if you took a person's blood at the moment of their death, you acquired their life force. In any case, we had taken over this prison farm as a refugee center. We had about 20,000 people who were mostly starving to death there, mostly from the Karamoja region in the north, although also from cities in the south, Soroto and Mbali and Jinja and such, because of the war. In fact, the vast majority of famine around the world happens as a result of war. And so a few months later, I'm flying back to Uganda with Dick Gregory, who was on our board of directors, or on our advisory board, rather. Back then, and who had done a couple of fundraisers and had become a pretty good friend, and he had never been to Africa before, and it was a hoot. And so it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're over the Atlantic, and we've both had a couple of glasses of wine, and we just can't sleep, and we're just chatting away. And he makes this comment. He says, and it's just burned into my brain. He says, we're talking about democracy. In fact, we were actually talking about the Vietnam War. And both of our experiences during that time, working against to try and stop the Vietnam War, or end the U.S. involvement in it. And he said, you know what I don't understand. He says, and I'm not even going to try to imitate his voice because it's so unique. But in any case, he says, you know what I don't understand. He says, what I don't understand is why America always has this tendency to run around the world trying to shove our way of life down people's throats with a barrel of a gun. He says, when you've got something good, you don't have to force it on people. They will steal it. And he says, and in fact, you know, it's, and this is just exactly the point that our last caller made about democracy. You can't force democracy on people. They have to steal it. They have to say, we want this. We are going to get this. We want this now. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You know, I hate to change the subject, but something really shocked me last night on Lou Dobbs' show.
That's fine. It's Friday, and we've been all over the map here anyway, Glenn. What's up?
Well, there was a study done in North Carolina about the effect on wages of illegal immigration by the University of North Carolina, and they found that in that one state, it had depressed wages $2 billion. And that doesn't even count the extra cost for schooling and health care for their children. And if you multiply that and even say $1 billion by 50 states, that's a huge cost. There was even a new hospital built out in California, Arizona, purposely without an emergency room, so they wouldn't be sent to bankruptcy by having to treat illegals.
Yeah.
What are we going to do about that? If you're a liberal, how are you supposed to look at that?
Well, it's interesting, Glenn, that you raise this, because I've been working on a piece for Common Dreams about this for a couple of weeks now, and I keep, you know, refine-tuning it, because it's a very delicate subject, and not delicate, it's a very complex subject. And I'll just give you my take on it straight up, and you know, thank you for calling and raising the issue. My take on it is that this is part of the conservative agenda, and the conservative agenda can always be boiled down to two words: cheap labor. And these guys are grandstanding on this whole issue of illegal immigration. They are, you know, you got the Minutemen out there, and the so-called conservatives are, on the one hand, kind of with a wink and a nod, encouraging this kind of thing because they want to bring along the racist vote. They want to bring along the fearful vote. They want to try and make it look like it's all about, uh-oh, those brown people are coming to get us. Right? I mean, there is this fundamental racist issue. But at the same time, the conservatives are aggressively encouraging illegal immigration by refusing to enforce any kind of legislation, any kind of laws, and there are laws in most states that would hold employers accountable for hiring illegals. And I'm telling you, if you were to pass a federal law tomorrow, I mean, here we have in the United States somewhere between 6 and 12 million illegal immigrants, the best guess probably around 10 million. They account for 10% of the total gross domestic product of Mexico, money sent home, second only to oil in terms of revenue for the country, which is why former Coca-Cola executive Vincente Fox is so incensed about this. If you were to pass a law tomorrow that said any CEO who hires an illegal immigrant goes to jail for 1 year, unnegotiable, you would have 10 million people standing at the Mexican border tomorrow morning trying to get out of the United States. You would have unemployment in the United States go to zero, and you would have wages go up and unionization go up because workers would once again have power. Now, on the other hand, there are some very real problems around this. What do you do about people who have been here illegally for 15 or 20 years and they have kids who are now U.S. citizens? I mean, you know, it starts to get complicated because we're talking about real human beings here. So we need to come to some sort of a solution, but we need to acknowledge that at the core of it, the whole issue of illegal immigration in the United States is really an issue about the conservatives trying to increase the supply of labor so they can decrease the price of labor, so they can bust unions, decrease worker power, essentially eviscerate the middle class, and enhance the power and wealth of the ruling conservative elite and the corporate elite in this country. That's the bottom line for it. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And Welcome back, my friends. The place where we run rings around the right wing every day, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. An analysis released today by the Institute for America's Future finds that retail behemoth Walmart...
I hate Walmart.
Oh, excuse me.
If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big companies sell at low cost, drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why I hate Walmart.
Well, indeed, here are our Walmart theme music. An analysis released today by the Institute for America's Future finds that retail behemoth Walmart sucked more than $20 billion out of local economies across America this holiday season. See, it's not just illegal immigration. Well, we were talking with Glenn in wherever Glenn is just a minute ago. It's not just illegal immigration. It is this whole race to the bottom. It is the whole conservative cheap labor thing, as Conceptual Gorilla says so brilliantly on the web, and that's gorilla as in the movement rather than the animal. You can look it up. That you can boil down the entire conservative agenda to two words: cheap labor. And the point that they make in this article, this analysis by the Institute for America's Future, is that Walmart's siphoning means a loss of billions in wages and benefits paid, lost purchases of inventory, supplies and services from other local businesses. See, here's the bottom line. When you have a local business, that local business is going to hire a local lawyer to do their incorporation papers and deal with their contracts. They're going to hire a local CPA to do their taxes. They're going to have local suppliers make their, you know, if it's a restaurant, for example, they're going to get their food from local suppliers and so on. I mean, when they go to deal with a bank, in all probability, they're going to want to deal with a local bank. You know, you want to do business locally. So when money is spent locally, you know, according to the Institute for Self-Reliance, local self-reliance, $100 spent in locally owned businesses provide the town and surrounding areas with $44.60. Because that money circulates through the economy. Whereas when it goes to a large retail chain, only $14.10 comes back to the local community. In other words, for every $100 spent at Walmart, the local community is losing $30.50. Where is the rest of it going? Where is that $20 billion going? It's going to Bentonville, Arkansas. And this is why the Walton family made $8 billion last year. And again, I'm not here to demonize Walmart or for that matter, the Walton family. They're playing by the rules of the game by and large. And when they're not, I mean, you know, of course, you know, hiring illegal immigrants or locking people in. I mean, you know, there are horror stories around Walmart and other big box retailers. And when they're caught, they should be prosecuted and pay the price for it. But the bottom line is that we have rules in this country right now that allow for this. That when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and the other laws subsequent to it, when Reagan basically said, okay, that's it, we're going to walk away from that, that the consequence of that was, and when large predatory corporations, particularly retail corporations, started using the 14th Amendment, which says no person can be discriminated against, all persons shall be entitled to equal protection under the law, when they started saying, oh, we're persons, which literally, I mean, this really started in 1936 with a lawsuit JCPenney had against the state of Florida, because the state of Florida was charging out-of-state chain stores a $25 a year tax, whereas local stores only paid a $5 a year tax in 1936. And JCPenney said, no, that's not fair. That's illegal discrimination. And the Supreme Court said, well, okay, I guess you're a person. So I guess, you know, local communities can't discriminate. They can't decide what the, you know, how they want it to be, what they want their community to be like. And that began this whole mess. Not just that. I mean, you could take it back to 1886 and the Santa Clara decision before the Supreme Court. But the point is that there is a race to the bottom going on in the United States. We have in this country, if you look back in the history of the country, we have always either been racing to the bottom or racing to the top. We have had two eras of the great middle class in America. There was the era of the great middle class in America in the late 1700s, early 1800s, that was basically based on free land and resources. people discovering gold and things, and stealing land from the Indians or taking land from, you know, a lot of disease. A lot of Indians were also killed by disease that were brought over from Europe. But, you know, however you want to characterize that, I have no problem with characterizing it as stealing land from the Indians. The largest line item in George Washington's budget was Indian warfare. So anyhow, but there was cheap land, and that created a relatively self-sufficient middle class in the United States. By the time of the Civil War, that middle class was vanishing because of the beginning of industrialization in the United States and the railroads and the rising of the robber barons. And by the 1870s, 1880s, that middle class had been wiped out by and large. There were still a lot of family farmers who were, you know, subsistence farmers. But they no longer represented essentially the American dream. And this led to the Grange movement of the 1880s and to the progressive movement of the 1880s, which oddly enough sprang out of the Republican Party. The Republican Party started in 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, was the Reform Party, because by that time the Democratic Party, which had been founded by Thomas Jefferson, was originally called the Democratic Republican Party back in 1798. When he was vice president under John Adams, that party by the 1850s, 1840s had become basically the party of Southern slavery, and had become so corrupt that there was this backlash, and so Abe Lincoln was the first, you know, really solid national presidential candidate of the brand new Republican Party, and it was a Reform Party. And it was through the 1850s, the 1860s, and the early 1870s through the if you read the platform of the Republican Party in 1872. And if you go to TomHartmann.com and click Articles on Democracy, there's a piece I wrote about 2 years ago. You can scroll down on that page. It's called Republicans, Please Take Your Party Back, in which I actually quote from the Republican Party platform of 1872. And it's a progressive platform. It calls for women's rights. It calls for women to have the right to vote. It calls for strong labor rights, to protect the right to unionize. It calls for progressive taxation. It's a very progressive platform. But within 4 years, the Republican Party was gone because Ulysses S. Grant and the people in his administration, the railroads started throwing money around like crazy. They were the biggest corporations in America. They were bigger than Microsoft. If you aggregated the four largest railroads and converted it to real dollars today, they were bigger than Microsoft. They were huge. They were such a power in Washington, D.C. They completely corrupted the Ulysses S. Grant. Arguably, until George W. Bush came along, one of the most corrupt administrations in the history of the United States. Of course, you know, Ronald Reagan has the distinction of being the president who had the greatest number of senior administration officials indicted or convicted of felonies. But it would have happened under the Grant administration if they simply hadn't resigned so many of them. So anyhow, the Republican Party, you know, went down in flames. So, and that was the end of the middle class. And we really didn't have much of a middle class from 1880 until the Great Depression. We had the average wage in the 1910s, the 1920s, the so-called Roaring Twenties. They were roaring for the robber barons. But the average wage in the United States in today's dollars was around $8,000 a year, between $8,000 and $9,000 a year. You had a lot of very, very poor. I mean, read books about the time. You know, read the old Horatio Alger novels. And then Franklin Roosevelt came along and he said, you know, we're not going to build a middle class on free land again because there isn't any more. So we're going to build a middle class by changing the rules of the game of business so that we don't have robber barons in this country anymore, but we have a middle class. We're all in favor, and by the way, he was building on what the Republican Teddy Roosevelt had been saying. If you want to run a business, there are certain rules you have to run it by, and these include paying people a living wage, allowing the power of aggregated capital, that is, the right of capital to organize in the form of a corporation, allowing that to be balanced by the right of labor to organize, forming a union. 1935, the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act. And by 1947, you had 35% of America unionized. It was the birth of the second great American middle class. And Ronald Reagan in 1981 began taking it apart. And there has been this organized war on the middle class ever since. And as I said earlier, in the last hour, illegal immigration, part of that. The whole Walmart mentality, another big part of that. And it's not, as I said, it's not just Walmart. I remember, you know, longer ago than I'd care to remember, when I was 17 years old, hitchhiking across the United States. Every city was different. Every town had its own unique character. Now, you can't, you know, I get off a plane in a city, and I had to look at the ticket to figure out where I am, because they all look the same. It's the great homogenization. It's a tragedy. And it is not a good thing for the American middle class, or for democracy. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
My name's O.W. and 41's my part. We hope you enjoyed shocking up. Halliburton's here to stay. No electricity today. Pull those in your blues away. My name is Rummy. How do you do? Have I got some metrics for you? What is knowable is that I'm full of bull. Bulldoze in your blues away.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman here with you. Prison near Kabul is being refurbished to house about 100 Afghans who are expected to be sent here from U.S. military custody at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, officials said. At the Policharki prison in Afghanistan, they are upgrading the thing to take 100 folks from Guantanamo. Interesting. They said the 110 Afghans are being held at the prison in Guantanamo Bay. I believe my recollection is there's about 500 people altogether being held down there, but perhaps I'm wrong. Apparently, only 100 or so of them are Afghans. And you have to ask yourself, you know, why now? What's going on? Could it be that these are the people who the Supreme Court would have said, you got to give them a trial? And the Bush administration, like with Jose Padilla, says, no, our case is so weak. We're not going to try them on the things that we're charging, you know, that we're claiming. We're saying, like they're saying, Padilla was going to build a dirty bomb. That's not what he's been charged with. So, anyhow, we'll see how it plays out. Interesting, and thanks to Blue in the chat room for the tip on that story. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Michael in Antioch, California. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wrote you an email about socialism. I was laid off by a Fortune 500 global corporation in 1997, and I've heard a lot of people say, well, hey, that's free enterprise, that's capitalism, that's what America's all about. And I was wondering, could we, through our Republican-Democratic system, become a socialist country? Is there some constitutional reason we couldn't?
Well, here's the problem, Michael. Define socialism.
Excuse me?
I said the problem is with the definition of socialism. If you have conservatives who will say and have been saying since the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt started doing this stuff that socialism is any kind of social programs, you know, on the one hand, right? I mean, this is the big split between my father and my grandfather. My grandfather was a socialist. My father's a Republican, right? This is their big argument. And what is it? And, you know, the FDR era versus the Eisenhower era, I guess you could say. So I'd say as far as, you know, the broad definition of socialism, there are some conservatives who say Social Security is socialism, unemployment insurance is socialism, minimum wage laws are socialism, that Medicare and Medicaid are socialism. And if that's your definition, then certainly it's constitutionally possible. On the other hand, if you're using the definition that Karl Marx came up with when he wrote Das Kapital, and that was referred to by the communists in the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which was that everything is the commons, that is, there is no separate ownership of property and there is no private property. You know, in other words, the government owns the entire means of manufacture and distribution, then no, I don't think that you could do that in the United States, nor do I think that anybody would want to, frankly. I mean, there's still a few people, you know, they say these guys on TV, they're always talking about the left, right? And they call me, like, on the, you know, here's Hartman, he's a lefty. I'm sorry, the lefties are all dead. Those are the communists from the 30s and the 40s, and they finally got, you know, they either got killed off by J. Edgar Hoover, or they figured out it ain't working in the Soviet Union. It might be a fine thing on a kibbutz in Israel or in a tribal society, but it doesn't work when you take it to the size of a nation state. And so that kind of socialism, no, I don't think we'd want. Am I answering your question, Michael?
Well, in Sweden, they have sort of a direct democracy type socialism, a referendum type socialism.
Right.
But they are a democratic republic, I guess, the way we
are.
Well,
they're actually a constitutional monarchy. But,
oh, okay.
Yeah, because there is a king of Sweden. But they, I would argue that Sweden is probably more democratic than the United States. Yeah, the people have more of a say in their own day-to-day lives via the legislative process than we do here in the United States, because money can't buy influence in Sweden the way it does here.
And that's basically what I'm talking about. And you know, health care, national health care would be a part of it. No, I'm not talking about the state becoming the corporation.
as
the corporation is now.
Right.
I'm just kind of saying, I trust the government, as hard as that is to believe, more than I trust the private. If we were to give all of our governance over to the private sector, I think we'd be in a lot of trouble.
Well, we can see that. I mean, try and negotiate with your health insurance company sometime. You know, I mean, you could see right now. The fact of the matter is, Social Security has never failed to write a check. You know, they have never missed a check. And
right.
If you've got a problem with Social Security, you can call your member of Congress. You actually have a representative that you can talk to, and they will take your call by and large, you know, or at least somebody on their staff will, and you usually get an answer. On the other hand, if you have a problem with your health insurance company, private for-profit health insurance company, good luck and God bless you, because that's as far as you're going to go, you know. You may have a prayer, but that's it. And so, yeah, Michael, in answer to your question, is socialism constitutionally possible? If socialism means moving toward a Swedish kind of democracy where there is a more robust social safety net, yes, it's absolutely constitutionally possible, in my opinion, and desirable. And in fact, that is the battle of our day, and it has been ever since Reagan became president. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, coming up on 25 before. You're in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Yeah, that's why I say it's the middle. And again, boy, I'm sure that my last quote as we were wrapping up, yes, I think socialism, been great. I don't identify myself as a socialist. I really believe, and I believe that there's a lot of empirical evidence out there to show it. Look at any of the opinion polls. I really believe that the positions that I take on this program, the positions that I hold, frankly, and therefore take on this program, are by and large the positions of America, that they are the historic positions of America, and they represent the vast majority, or at least the significant majority, of today's Americans, whether it has to do with international trade, whether it has to do with immigration, whether it has to do with minimum wage policies, whether it has to do with Social Security or Medicare or any of the other issues that you want to talk about today, abortion, right across the board. I guess that more than 50% of Americans are in favor of capital punishment. I'm opposed to it. So there, I guess I'm out of the mainstream. But on all the other issues, when you do polls on ask Americans where they stand, and you're going to find more than half of them are where I'm at. So I'm not saying that that's why I'm there or that's why it's a good thing or anything like that. But what I'm saying is that to characterize these kinds of positions as left, as the mainstream media constantly does, is to play into and to use the talking points of the Reich, the right, the extreme right wingers. And frankly, I don't think that that's a good thing for America. I just have to say, you know, because the real left is dead and gone. The real socialists are, they're, you know, We had a guy from the Communist Party of the United States of America on as a guest about 3 months ago, just to show you what an anachronism these guys are. I mean, you know, they're the dinosaurs. So anyhow, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Or afternoon, or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's close.
Yeah.
Hello, Oregon. This is Pennsylvania.
There you go.
you're right. I personally do want to talk briefly, if I may, about the direct parallel, I believe, between the late rest his soul, Lee Atwater, and the Bush-Cheney, Jack Abrahoff, if you will, culture of politics. But before I do, I just want to briefly say I totally agree with you. I think the media fears their own. I think some of the media, there's a lot of good ones, though, fear their own tongue.
Mm. How so?
Well, just I think how did you say? What you just said. They fear their own tongue in that they won't. They know the difference between right and wrong. They have a responsibility to their job, but they also have a responsibility to the truth and democracy.
Oh yeah, and they're not pursuing it in so many cases.
No, they're not.
In my opinion,
right. Now getting back.
But that's not what you called about.
Yeah, Lee Atwater. I think, and I want you to espouse on this too, because you do a better job at it than me. The direct parallel between, I believe, Lee Atwater and his politics and his philosophy and the Bush and now and the Bush Cheney Abrahoff culture of politics,
yes,
and leading the Republican Party down the drain and trying to bring along us with it.
For our listeners who aren't old enough to remember or who weren't paying attention to politics back, you know, in that day,
right?
Lee Atwater was the advisor to Ronald Reagan, who Ronald Reagan's campaigns, and then later to George Herbert Walker Bush's campaign.
And also the chairman of the Republican Party.
Right, the chairman of the RNC, who devised the Willie Horton ads against Michael Dukakis, whose philosophy was win at all costs. It doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. If it helps you win,
exactly,
do it. Say, you know, that character assassination is more effective than talking about the issues, so always try to destroy your opponent's character rather than trying to discuss the issues.
Yes.
Simplify things. The average American is dumb, in his opinion. This is Lee Atwater. You know, just this whole, the politics of personal destruction, the politics of black and white. That was Lee Atwater. And he got brain cancer, and on his deathbed.
Yes, that's the point I wanted to bring
Go ahead. Well, on his deathbed, he gathered some friends around, and he said, I want to apologize for everything
wrong
I did and for the way that I have harmed this country, and please ask the people who follow me to not engage in these kinds of politics because it's destructive to the United States. And one of his main proteges was Karl Rove. And so I would say Abramoff isn't so much Lee Atwater's spiritual descendant as was Karl Rove.
Right,
or is Karl Rove.
And if I could just finish up, if I may, and, I know you're short for time. This is why I believe to the heart of me, to the very heart of me, FDR said it best, and I know it verbatim. I'm not reading anything. Government can err, presidents can make mistakes, but we are told that divine justice weighs the sins of the cold-blooded and the sins of the warm-hearted on a different scale. Better the occasional fault of a government, or a president for that matter, living in a spirit of charity, than the consistent omission of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
Yeah.
That's what I believe.
I think it's very well said, and
FDR, it was FDR, that's his whole philosophy. We need it terribly, in my opinion.
Yeah, and well said, and it's been totally and completely forgotten. It's
best wishes, Tom.
Thank you very much, Gary. Good to hear from you. In fact, I think I may even have
those possessions in their power.
No, that's not the. I thought it was. I thought I had that clip, but apparently.
The Japanese government.
No, I don't. Anyway, let's move along here. Nick in Monterey, California. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'd like your take on the Middle East situation, Tom, specifically clarification on the Balfour Declaration following World War One.
The Balfour Declaration was in 1917 when, was it Lord Balfour said that he was speaking on behalf of the British government, said that they were in favor of establishing a Jewish homeland, basically, in the Middle East.
Right. Now, wasn't that accepted?
I don't know. I'm not a scholar of Middle Eastern history. I'm sorry. I'm not a scholar of much of anything, really. But it's I don't present myself as a scholar. But I don't know. I know that the Balfour Declaration was put out there. I know ultimately, that thinking. I mean, the Zionist movement at that time had been pushing for a Jewish homeland for a long time. I can tell you that from when back in the 80s when I was working on a book on the religion of the Nazis that Hitler. Adopted a lot of his ideas. I don't want to say that. Hitler looked at the Zionist movement and said, "This is really the idea of people coming together around a racial identity or a religious identity is a very powerful thing." And therefore, Hitler said the Nazis needed to do that same thing. And that's why you had Rudolf Hess. Of course, co-authored Mein Kampf with Hitler. That's why you had Rudolf Hess start using, in 1934 at the Nuremberg rallies, Rudolf Hess came out and started using the word Heimach, the Heimach zu sehen für alles Deutsche, über die ganze Welt. Heimat is the German word for homeland, because Germany had always been referred to by the German people, not as the homeland, but as the fatherland. And or as Germany or as Greater Germany, and of course there was local identities, Prussia and whatnot. And so here, in fact, this is Rudolf Hess rolling out the word homeland.
Dank Ihrer Führung.
Thanks to the Führer.
Wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen.
So now Germany is going to arise again as the homeland.
Heimat zu sein.
The homeland
für alle Deutschen der Welt.
For all the Germans. For all the Germans in the world, right? And off he goes. And that's, so we're way afield here of the Balfour Declaration, but as I said, that's pretty much all I know about the Zionist movement back at that time, was that the Nazis took it in one direction and then Israel was created, which I think was a great thing.
Yeah. Well, I think it would clear up a lot of things, Tom, if we would know whether the Balfour Declaration is considered legal today, because it did guarantee the Palestinians a state and the Jews only a homeland, denied them a state, and it would explain the Palestinians' attitude toward the United States today, since we are backing Israel, and they would consider that illegal.
Well, the exact language here is, "Dear Lord Rothschild, His Majesty's government view in favor of the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this project." I don't think it is parsing it quite that tightly, Nick. And the thing that concerns me, and let me just put this on the record, is that there are people who, essentially anti-Semitic folks, who are using those kinds of arguments to try and just, reverse 60 years of history or more and say, there shouldn't be an Israel. And I'm not in that camp. I'm sorry. I think that, Israel is a functioning democracy in the Middle East, and a fine one at that. And all in favor of its existence and its presence I don't know if that makes me anything in particular, but the Balfour Declaration, I think, was just part of that whole process. But as I said, I don't know that much about it. Jim in Pittsburgh, we just have a few seconds.
It's been reported the Abramoff money was extorted from the Indian casinos.
Right.
Now, being that the politicians, which we have two, Melissa Hart, the congresswoman, and Rick Santorum in Pennsylvania, that accepted this money. Now they're accepting stolen goods. Am I correct?
Well, arguably.
Now they give it to charitable organizations who is also receiving stolen goods. Shouldn't these people in the charitable organizations be treated the same as Spiro Agnew when he was taking bribes in office?
You make a good case for it, Jim. You make a very good case for it. We'll see how it plays out. By the way, my whole rant about homeland before was, I see George Bush rolling out the word homeland. It gives me chills.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just another poor boy off the pine, a rich man's war.
And welcome back, my friends.
Bobby and me
tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue, the ball will land in Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. I stack overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still there. Chasing ghosts and thin dry air. Meanwhile, back at home, the fine has come and he took his car. He's just another poor boy off to find a rich man's war.
9 minutes before the hour, the pill that will help you escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. I found my FDR clip. It's such a great quote one of our callers shared with us. I thought you might want to hear the original. Here we go.
Better the occasional fault of a government that lives in a spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
There you go. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Joy in Whatcom County, Washington. Hey, Joy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
I wanted to discuss something that you touched on just a bit ago, private versus public management of certain functions.
Right.
I am no socialist, but I do believe that government has a unique place in certain aspects of our lives. And my specific example is the post office, which became private back in 1972 when Nixon signed the orders, and I only found out recently that they're controlled by a board, but it's not a board that has anything to do with Congress. It's under the executive branch.
Right.
I was finally able to have a home built 5 years ago, and I'm in a hilly area. All of Western Washington is hilly, and I cannot get mail delivered to me, even though I lived on a highly used, highly maintained, paved county road with the yellow stripes and the white stripes, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Because the post office decrees that they are going to deliver to me a third of a mile away because it's the foot of a hill where there's an S curve and an elevation change of 130 feet. Even though, by law, because I'm handicapped and have to use canes to climb up and down that hill, they are ignoring the HEW rule, which specifically applies.
Joy, I get your complaint, the level of detail, I think,
is... I won't do a thing about it. I've been fighting them for 5 years.
Have you talked to your member of Congress?
I have, and he tried, and they keep saying, well, we'll get to it, and they don't. Or it's been a cycle for 5 years.
Yeah. Well,
but he's not doing anything because it's the executive branch.
And obviously you're not going to call the president.
Well, I can't afford to. I'm a senior, and I'm badly handicapped, and it's very painful.
And you don't know Jack Abramoff.
No.
Yeah.
Gosh, darn, I wish I had. I mean,
yeah,
no, it wouldn't help.
it's almost what it takes to get to it. Well, Joy, I empathize with your situation. I'm sorry I don't have an easy solution for you, and I agree with you that there are some things that we should have government do, and there are some things that private industry should do, and I think it's amazing that for 30-some-odd cents I can send a piece of paper, you know, all the way across the United States, all the way around the world for that matter, but I think it's tragic that you can't get the mail delivered to your house, and I wish you well in your battle.
The road is too dangerous. That's how they're getting around the handicap.
No, well, I understand that, Joy, and you know, like I said, I'm not there, and I can't fight that fight for you, but I empathize with you, and I wish you the very best on it. I really do. Just quickly looking back over the week in review, Media Matters for America did a marvelous summary. Newsweek, just some of the tragedies of this week. Newsweek downplayed Republican and conservative objections to Bush's domestic surveillance program. Here we had a number of Republicans coming out and objecting to Bush spying on Americans without a warrant. And Newsweek kind of ignored that, by and large, as documented by, you can find all this at MediaMatters.org, by the way, if you want the specifics and all the details. I just want to give you the overview here. A number of media outlets have continued to falsely report that Congress was fully informed about the program. The Washington Post, for example, reported without challenge the disputed claim that the Bush administration, quote, repeatedly consulted Congress end quote, about domestic spy program. Not true, turns out. O'Reilly falsely claimed that Bush kept full congressional intel committees informed of the wiretapping program. Again, you know, just pulling stuff out of his left ear, or his right ear, or whatever. Some reports continue to distort Representative Jane Harman, a Democrat of California's statement, to make it appear that she supports the domestic spying program, leaving out her comments that, quote, I am deeply concerned by reports that this program, in fact, does go far beyond the measures to target Al-Qaeda, about which I was briefed. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see, by the way, over this weekend with the Sunday news shows and all this kind of thing, if this story of why was it that Andrea Mitchell, the wife of Alan Greenspan and senior NBC correspondent, raised the question with Jim Ryson, the author of this, the New York Times reporter and author of this new book on, you know, that exposes the illegal spying program that Bush has been promulgating here. Why was it that Andrea Mitchell asked him if the NSA had been illegally spying on Christiane Amanpour, who happens to be married to Jamie Rubin, who's the guy who was standing in for John Kerry over and over and over again throughout the 2004 campaign. I mean, of all the correspondents in the world, you're going to pick to spy on the one, you know, you say, oh, you know, correspondents, these international correspondents, they might be talking to Al-Qaeda. We need to listen in. You're going to pick the one whose husband is working for John Kerry's campaign, and he's on all the talk shows. I don't get it. You know, it's just it's over the top. It's way too much. Thanks so much for being with us, my friends, this week. Thanks so much to David Poole and Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark and Dan Jacobs at Air America, to Ben and Shelby at the White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our archives on this website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening. We'll see you next week, same time, same place. I'm Tom Hartman. Remember, activism begins with you.
To the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.